You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad. Now this week's a little different in that Scott and I have decided not to do an intro or outro. We're both really busy. Scott's been away and work things have been crowding in. But what we did instead is we had an interview together with Annie Crombie. Now I've known Annie for about 7 years nearly, and we first met when she was speaking at a conference on behalf of the Children's Minister. Now, Annie's moved on since then, no longer works with the Department for Education, but has an interesting role within the adoption world, and I thought it'd be really helpful to get some of her insights, someone who's worked within government, but also works within the voluntary sector as well. So Scott and I are going to have a chat, and that interview will be coming up in just a short minute. But I'd like to give you a heads up around an event that Scott and I are both hosting with We Are Family in London, in Islington, on the 12th of July. Now, we're going to be talking about child-on-parent violence, and I'm going to be presenting some of the information that I've drawn out of the survey and the reports that Dr. Winter Thorley put together. It's going to be a really interesting evening, and I would encourage you, if you can and you're around on the 12th of July, to get along. Scott and I are both going to be sharing some of our own experiences and insights. We're going to make it fun, we're going to make it interesting, all in the context of a very serious issue. The places are limited, but I would really encourage you, if you can get along on the 12th of July, that'd be wonderful. There's a couple of ways you can do that. You can do that through the We Are Family website, or you can look through my timeline, which is at Nadja Smith on my Twitter profile, or through Scott's, which is at Gay Adoption Dad, or you can look on my Facebook page, which is Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad. But if you search it, you'll no doubt find it pretty quickly. Well, with no more ado, I'm going to put on the interview with Annie. So I hope you're all well and having a nice summer, and I shall see you soon. With no more ado, I'll put the interview with Annie on, and I hope you all stay well. Okay, well, we're here today with Annie Crombie. And Annie, tell us about who you are and what you do.
So I am the chief executive of the Consortium of Voluntary Adoption Agencies, and I'm also the board manager for the Adoption Leadership Board.
Ah, that's interesting. So how long have you been doing the CVAA?
2 years. 2 A's. 2 years.
2 A's, 2 years, right. So what is the function of the CVAA?
So we're a... I describe it differently depending on my mood. So we're a... Sometimes I think we're a sort of adoption think tank. Sometimes we're like a sort of trade body, all of the voluntary adoption agencies trying to work out what will work for them and what will enable them to do their thing in the best way. Sometimes we're like an information service for voluntary adoption agencies trying to make sense of what happens at national level. Sometimes we're a social club. We do, you know, networking, get chief execs together so they can let off steam and share their experiences. So we've got different roles.
Right. Because, I was thinking about this interview and thinking about, well, what are we going to talk about? And I thought, we've already had a conversation. We had a cup of coffee together. It was very nice. And we talked a little bit about the changes over the last few years. And I'm aware that it is a time potentially of anxiety for a lot of smaller agencies. There's been a sense of constant change and evolving change, and in some ways voluntary adoption agencies are small players now. So is there an anxiety? What's your take on the changes in the systems or the proposed changes?
So I suppose one thing I'd say is the voluntary adoption agencies are really different organisations. Some of them are really small, and they just do adoption, and they've been doing adoption for years and years. Some of them are small and new and have been set up as part of this new, as the recent government focus, and that led to some grants for some new organisations and some new voluntary adoption agencies. But some of them... some of them are massive. Some of them are huge organisations like Barnardo's or Action for Children, and they do adoption as a small part of what they do. And then there's other ones which are sort of quite kind of big innovators, entrepreneurs in adoption. And one of the things that for me has been interesting, actually, is that it's been some of the, I think, the bigger organisations that are more, that have taken more upon themselves, which I mean in a good way. You know, they've tried to be more engaged in the reforms, where the uncertainty and the turbulence has probably been harder to deal with in business terms, as well as, of course, offering lots of opportunities for new ideas and stuff as well.
Yeah, I guess some of those names are household names, aren't they? You know, you talk about Bernardo's, you talk about Coram to an extent.
Yeah.
And so in some ways their future is perhaps a bit more assured. But I'm thinking of, I know small agencies that are actually really quite anxious.
Mm.
And what do you think the future holds for those smaller agencies?
So I've been thinking about this quite a lot because there's been loads of change, hasn't there? But I think if you look at it from the lens of a voluntary adoption agency, most of them, although there's a few new ones, most of them have existed for years and years and years, like hundreds of years in quite a lot of cases, and they've been through heaps of change. So some of them were church organisations. They've detached from the church. They've been through all of the tumult around the introduction of discrimination legislation, which meant that for some of them, you know, they have to cut adrift, often in bad circumstances, sometimes not, from the church. You know, so they've had a massive leap. They've seen Tony Blair's adoption reforms. I mean, they've seen legislation introduced in the 70s, 80s, 90s, then massive focus on adoption in 2000, then this new set of reforms. And so actually, like, change is the normal in many ways, I think, for voluntary adoption agencies.
So they're flexible and...
Not to understate, it's been really difficult.
Yeah.
And, in many ways, the sort of decline in adoptions that we saw from late 2013 and then over the 18 months that followed that was... I mean, probably unprecedented, but we know we don't have data to tell us that definitively. But it's a sort of, I think for many of them, it's probably, if you kind of zoom out a bit and you kind of hover above a slightly bigger bit of time, what I'm interested in at the moment is that I think voluntary adoption agencies will always be there. They won't be the same. They'll be doing something different. They are, I think for years they've been a kind of, like a sort of safety valve in a system. Like, what is the system not managing to do? And there's always a new challenge and something that, you know, that the system isn't doing well enough. And that'll be, you know, and they'll need to sort of push themselves into those different areas. But that's kind of been their role in the system for...
So I guess, in some ways, that the kind of smaller organisations that we're talking about, they are coming on board as voluntary adoption agencies, but they know that they've got to have a bit of a kind of niche market to be able to survive.
Yeah.
Actually, and they know it's constantly changing. So I'm guessing that nobody would willingly set up a voluntary adoption agency and not know about those risks.
Yeah, I think so. And also not want to do something about them. So if you look at... If you look at what voluntary adoption agencies do at the moment, like, some of them are really specialist in particular sorts of adoption support and sort of doing things that where there's a niche, you know, where you can't have that kind of expertise right across the mainstream. Yeah. All of them place children with needs that are the more complex end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And they're a much bigger part of our national resource for placing those sorts of children than they are if you look at their role in the market as a whole, because they've had to do that, because actually that's been where the need is. And so to survive as businesses, they've got to be able to find adopters and support adopters so they can look after children with particular needs.
And I guess that's a constant, isn't it? There's always been that cohort of children, perhaps large sibling groups, complex emotional needs, physical disabilities, those sort of children, and they remain at a constant level, give or take.
Yes.
The local authorities have found them useful.
Yes.
And they go, hey, they're a specialist service. There's things like
exactly. And there's if you look at the latest data, there are I think the latest data we've got 590 children who've been waiting for 18 months or more waiting for adopters. Now those are children who will have like a range of different but complex needs, and that's still a challenge that we've not met, isn't it? Because those are children that don't have families that have got placement orders and are looking for adopters, and so there's still a job to be done for
those children.
Yeah, for those children.
Because that's interesting, because when you look at the statistics, they've often, you know, when the balance tipped and there was more adopters than there was children, there was still that cohort of children because they were approving.
Yeah.
Cookie cutter families, maybe? Am I being unkind? I'm looking at you, Scott.
Well, I don't know if I would have called them that, but.
Well, let's not call them. I retract that phrase. I retract the cookie cutter. More conventional families.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are easy to approve. They go through the process really quickly and easily. But the children that they perhaps are more willing to take out, there's less of them.
Mm-hmm. But I think as well, I mean, I guess this has kind of gone away from the discussion with Annie in a little bit, but, you know, as someone who's, well, you've adopted siblings as well, I always struggle with the thought that actually that's quite a specialist thing and that voluntary agencies can do that more than a local authority, because I was a local authority doctor and my children were placed through a local authority and stuff. So I guess in my mind, and it may just be language and it may just be that kind of historical view on it, that harder to place for me is more about disabilities and ethnic backgrounds rather than sibling groups. But the more we go on, the more I'm seeing sibling groups included in that. But as somebody who's had a sibling group, I promote it, you know. I don't see it as specialist, I see it as just part of my family.
It's not
But some don't see it that way, and I think
well, I mean, but we do, like, we do know that sibling groups wait longer, don't we? In a way, exactly. What that tells you is that there's a need for more adopters who are willing to take sibling groups, whether that's from, you know, whoever approves them. But, I mean, you know, what's enabled the voluntary sector to kind of be a constant through all of this is that they, you know, they have to meet the need that's out there, and so that sort of pushes them into maybe specialising, as some of them do, in, like, trying to find adopters for larger groups of children, or... And I guess also the other thing that I think is one of the things that I think is interesting about them is they don't, and helpful to our system, is they don't, like, map onto the local authority boundaries. You know, so we have this system which is all kind of chunked up around different geographical entities, and then we've got the voluntary sector, which, like, sort of sits in, is a different shape. And actually, that's quite helpful because they can like work with different like populations and demographics and communities, and they can like work across boundaries, if that makes sense. And I think there'll always be a need for that sort of flexibility and that additional layer in the system. However it develops,
because it's a marketplace. Ultimately, it's a marketplace, isn't it? And you want options. You know, as a buyer, you want that. Is that harsh? Too harsh a set of language? But that's the reality, isn't it? You're buying a service from a small independent agency, and they can offer you something that you perhaps won't get. And maybe that's the type of children, but also the support that they may offer. And I've got friends who adopted through a small agency, and their support was just top draw. There was a sense of person, very personal, enduring. Long, you know, they've had the same social worker for maybe 7 or 8 years, and even though their place was closed, I used in brackets, and they would ring up the social worker and he'd pop around at birthdays, and he was kind of this for a lot of people, I know that's something I would benefit from, like an open door kind of feeling, just to chat or record things on the system.
We did a bit of with Adoption UK, I think, actually. A year or so ago, trying to understand what do adopters particularly value from their voluntary adoption agency, and it was that element of that continuity, that sense that staff don't really change, so you'd probably be able to ring up and get hold of the person who...
Someone knows. Knows you, knows your child, knows his story.
That your files won't have been moved anywhere because they've got their... They work out the same office and the filing cabinets in the same place, and they're not subject to the... same stresses and strains of kind of corporate realities as a local authority.
Reorganisation. There's a team of three, what's your reorganisation?
And I think, interestingly, with the voluntary sector as well, that with regionalisation, being involved in some of those projects, there's real innovative ideas coming from the voluntary adoption agencies, and they're one of the projects I'm involved in, you know, they've got a number of work streams, and the lead on the adoption support, the work that they are putting into this is massive. You know, they've come up with 14, 15 kind of things that they'd like to see changed. And then some of the other work streams are, you know, no disrespect to local authorities, but they are led by the local authority staff, and they've got one or two little kind of suggestions to make, and that's just maybes, whereas they're very, you know, the voluntary sector are really kind of, they don't even know what's in it for them at this stage, but they're really picking it up and they're really being innovative. And I think that actually, you know, if they could work like that together anyway, it would just improve the system, without a doubt.
It's been a good and unexpected, I think, from, I hadn't foreseen it, but it's been a benefit of the regionalisation programme has been, I think, that some of those relationships and partnerships, those conversations about, is this really how we want to run our service? Like, what's the best that we've got in this area in terms of knowledge and understanding about what we could do? And actually, let's start afresh and let's ask our communities of users or potential users, and then let's think about what are all the tools in the toolbox in terms of the different expertise and services across statutory and voluntary sector. And I think, like, that has helped to join up some of the gaps maybe between the two bits of the system.
So I guess you've spanned that really well as a positive, that the agenda to move towards regionalisation, there's scope for real positives, innovation, and hopefully that they will be allowed to do that, your organisations will be allowed and given the breathing space and not kind of stuffed into a corner and told, you know, keep in your box, do as you're told. But it still must remain an anxious time, I'm sure it does, for the little ones. I am also aware that you've done a lot of work around adoption for a lot of years, haven't you? You've kind of got, not a lot of years, because you're only 27.
I'm 39.
No.
Yeah.
No, shut the front door. But I know you've worked within the DfE, and you've kind of... What made you move to the CVA? Why did you do that?
So I was... I did work on adoption in the DfE in 2011, 2012, 2013. And then I stopped working on adoption because I had another baby. And the way that things work in the civil service is that, you know, you're a government resource. So you sort of go where you're told to a degree. And I went to work on adoption because there was a sudden increase in interest and a lot of political interest and, you know, we needed new people. And then I moved on to, when I came back from having my child, I moved on to a different area of work in the DfE. And I suppose I'd always wanted to have a go at working from a different perspective, really. You know, I'd wanted to try, I didn't want to become a kind of Whitehall Mandarin that only understood the corridors of power. I only understand the corridors of power. I wanted to know about what it was like to kind of actually, like, deliver services, because I do think if you want to be able to make policy, you need to understand how that's going to become a reality on the ground, and you can't do that properly unless you understand the constraints and the potential of organisations that are delivering services. Mm-hmm. So this job with the CVAA was an opportunity to sort of use my skills in understanding the national picture, but also get a bit closer to that reality.
So a progression for you your interests and what you're passionate about.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I've also been this kind of children's social care and kind of how society works with children that can't live with their birth parents, and then with all of the parties that are affected by and part of that story. That's something that I find really interesting in terms of the ethics and the policy and...
So it's a unique perspective you've got, really, because you've straddled both those worlds and involved in both those worlds.
Well, my next
question is, I want you to polish the crystal ball. And we've got a vision for 2020.
Uh-huh.
That's what it's called, isn't it? Vision for 2020. 2030.
Mm-hmm.
2040.
Yeah.
2050. When you're, you know, in charge. 2050, in charge of everything.
Yes.
Whatever.
You're the president of the United Kingdom.
Well, you're the president of the United States of England or something. We shouldn't talk politics. Please don't. What do you think is the long-term future for adoption? unique perspective.
So, I think the voluntary adoption agencies will still exist. I think that adoption will continue to evolve. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, it already is evolving in some ways, and that bits of it are going to need to catch up in the future. I think that, you know, we need to think about what kind of adoption, what kind of permanent lifelong families work in 2030 and 2040 and 2050, and our understanding of what children need and how children best thrive when they've been subject to difficult, traumatic early experiences will continue to change. And I think the system will need to catch up with both the realities of society that we live in and also some of that greater understanding.
And that's interesting, because as you said, that made me think that often adoptive families are kind of the most conventional families, increasingly, because we're still harking back to an ideal of a mother and a father, and a Labrador and a Volvo and adopted children that are adopted. But actually, that's not reflected in my neighbourhood.
No.
It's not reflected in my community. Like, families are so different to how they were. But adoptive families, I'm sure we don't. That is pretty much... It's still the dominant model, isn't it?
And I guess that comes down to the you know, I guess some families are different where they've had both children, then they've fostered and then gone on to adopt. And I think that, you know, there's, in my own situation as an example, you know, we just thought, oh, we can have children now legally, so let's adopt.
Mm.
Not really understanding the kind of wider issues.
Yeah.
Through today's adoption kind of system, because it's moved on since, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, and it will continue to move on. But in terms of what fits and the language we use and all that, that kind of all needs to change. So, you know, and we were talking earlier about, you know, some of the language that we see people use in other areas about their families. Mm. You know, they are still very much, you know, this is my child.
Yes.
But actually, you know, in other countries, that's, you know, it doesn't fit, does it?
Exactly. So my children go to school in central London, and they have children from all over the world in their classes, and some of them have got split families who are living in different countries, and all sorts of complicated and different kind of totally different cultural norms that have come together through two parents from different types of society. And I just think that's the reality of family life, and I think adoption will become more reflective of that reality, which will probably mean thinking hard about the role of contact, and about how adoptive families and birth families and wider relatives become less perhaps contain the one from the other.
Yeah,
that's interesting, because I think Facebook's forcing social change on us in the sense that I know that adoptive families say, well, how can I stop? And I go, you can't.
Mm.
You need to get ready for the Facebook contact, because it's not an if, it's a when.
Yeah.
And so that makes us think differently about the relationships we have with those families.
Mm.
And do we want to make preemptive relationships with them
to
get in there first and set the ground?
And just to do a plug, I think that voluntary adoption agencies, because they're often known because it's kind of what it says on the tin for their adoption work, but actually what I've learned about them, but only since I took up this job, is that they many of them do loads of work with birth families in intermediary work and supporting contact.
Yeah.
Some of them do kind of breaking the cycle projects, working with birth families it more intensively. The therapeutic work they sometimes do also with extended families and with birth families and such like. And I think that that's, you know, what they have there to help us to think about adoption moving forward is a really important thing they can bring to the system, which is all the more reason why they're likely to still be around in 20, 30, 40, 50.
That's really encouraging, a really positive view that I've not particularly given much thought to. But and also I work for small organisations and always have done. I think one of their strengths is they can turn on a dime. They can go, this isn't working, let's do something else. Let's change it. Let's tinker with that. Whereas big organisations like potentially the regional adoption agencies or big local authorities, you know, it's committee, subcommittee, you know, directors meet and have a think and then go, well, we'll think about it. You've missed the moment. Or things have moved on. Well, that's really interesting. Is there anything you wanted to tell me?
Goodness, no.
I've asked all the right. Is there anything you want to tell me? Annie?
Maybe what my favourite colour is.
Yeah, what is your favourite colour today?
Well, some days it's pink. But today it's blue.
This is a very serious podcast. Do you not know?
It was never going to be serious when you and I were in the same room interviewing somebody.
Yeah, it's a lovely cafe, isn't it? We're in.
It's not. It's the London offices of everybody who works in London.
We saw someone famous, didn't we?
Well, you did. I don't know who it was.
Yeah. Didn't we? We saw someone famous.
Yeah, we did see someone famous. There's lots of famous people here. Mm. It's very glamorous.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, thank you very much, Annie. That's been really helpful. And thank you, Scott, for... It's nice to see you in person. Is this our first time we've met you?
Honestly, he keeps on banging on about this. We don't know each other. We've never met.
No. Okay, well, I'll say goodbye to you. Thank you very much, Annie. That's been really, really helpful. And no doubt we will talk again.
I hope so.
Yeah.